This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off doing the people's work. Coming up, the Obama administration was given $7 billion for homeowners hardest hit by the housing crisis, but failed to spend all but a fraction of it. And do African Americans have the right to self-determination within what is now the United States? But first, Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota has introduced legislation that would cut spending along the lines of the Deficit Reduction Commission that was appointed by President Obama. The so-called Simpson-Bowles Commission called for huge cuts in social programs, including Social Security. A coalition of organizations is calling for the measure's defeat. Don Owens of Social Security Works says Simpson-Bowles would wreck America's main social safety net.
It presents a clear and present danger to Social Security, and it presents a clear and present danger to the African American community specifically, because Social Security is a major source of income for African Americans. For many African Americans, 65 years of age or older, it's their only form of income. If you work, especially in a blue-collar field, a welder, a roofer, you worked in a convenience store or supermarket, not too many businesses out there are hiring 68 and 69-year-old workers. But the Conrad Amendment is especially dangerous because it's a backdoor attempt to reduce benefits. And Americans, especially African Americans, in national polls have proven time and again that they've invested too much in this program to give up to a backdoor attempt to cut their benefits.
A lot of African Americans, especially men, don't even live to be 69, which would be the full retirement age under the Simpson-Bowles plan.
Yes, sir. That is one of the myths that is being propagated by supporters of the Simpson-Bowles plan. And also, you remember back to the debt limit discussion last year, there were rumblings here on Capitol Hill that they were going to, one of the negotiating points was Social Security. Now, one of the talking points they used was this. Well, couldn't we shore up Social Security by extending the retirement age, i.e. making the retirement age higher? That naturally is a detriment to many minorities and people of color because we have lower life expectancies. But secondly and most importantly, not everyone in America is living longer. If you look at certain segments of our society and longevity rates, it's those who earn higher incomes, who are from the upper middle and upper income levels, who are living longer. African Americans who live in the South aren't living as long as people in other parts of the country. So this is really, again, an end-around attempt to take away the benefits or reduce the benefits of a program that African Americans and Americans across the country have invested in for the last 76 years. We've got specific stats for African Americans. One of every five children in the country who receive Social Security are African American. 21% of those folks who receive it nationwide are African Americans. And that works out to roughly 15% of all children in the country. African Americans are more likely than whites to work in hazardous jobs. So the relative frequency with which their spouses and children receive the disability benefits is greater than that for white workers. So this is a key bedrock issue for African Americans. It's part of the promise of being a full citizen in this country, and we should fight for it. It's not government money. It's your money. And the final point I'll make on that, these folks are talking about they're trying to fix Social Security. There's nothing wrong with Social Security. It hasn't missed a payment in 76 years since it was created in 1935. And if you think about it, it's the one part of the government that has worked and worked well. So we should fight against fully any backdoor attempts to reduce benefits because, again, this is not government money. This is money that belongs to the people who earned it. And any politician, Democrat or Republican, who tries to say, but we need to pay down the deficit, Social Security doesn't contribute to the deficit, not one penny.
And that is the point. It's not part of the deficit, so how can this be part of a general austerity plan?
All this is propagated by Republicans and supported by some Democrats is a backdoor attempt to try to appease what are called the fiscal hawks on Capitol Hill. But Social Security works. We should keep it working. It has not contributed a penny to the deficit. And again, if you think about our highway system, our military, some of the assets here in America that we're most proud of, what we're most known around the world, Social Security is one of those assets. Countries around the world have tried to copy our system because it's worked since 1935. And much like our other resources, we shouldn't throw that resource away, which is what Senator Conrad, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, and Republicans in Congress are trying to do. They're trying to get the American people and say, hey, throw this asset away, go gamble your money on Wall Street, and that all sounds good when times are good. But when we have crashes, and we've had three in the last 20 years, American workers suffer, and the numbers show that African-American workers suffer more than almost any other group.
George Bush made his move against Social Security, and he was soundly beaten. Your organization says that they're trying to bring back an attack on Social Security by stealth.
Yes. When George W. Bush put out his idea that he wanted to privatize Social Security, Americans from around the country, not just Democrats, not just African Americans, polling on Social Security going back six decades, going back to the 40s and 50s, shows that Americans of all different political backgrounds support this program. Even the Tea Party folks, those folks you saw dressed as Revolutionary War characters, they show up to rallies and say, keep the government out of my life, but don't mess with my Medicare or Social Security. Folks know that when they received a paycheck, and that's essentially what conservatives are saying, that when you received a paycheck, that you were driving up the deficit. It's not true. And President Bush took a gamble, and his favorability ratings took a brutal beating, which is by the time he left office, he was one of the most unpopular presidents of all time. Even with his military success, he was derided by many Americans because he tried to privatize Social Security. And we're here sending a message to President Obama. Stop including Social Security as a bargaining chip because Americans have earned it. And remember, this isn't just a program for the elderly, for senior citizens. Social Security is very important for children whose parents have been killed on the job, Americans with disabilities who receive Social Security payments. This is as an American as any idea since this country was founded, and the program belongs to the people.
President Obama has been including Social Security as among the entitlements that would be put on the table since actually 2 weeks before he was even inaugurated.
Yes, sir. It's interesting that you mention that because this isn't a new approach from the president, unfortunately. One of the reasons this organization was created is during the campaign, we didn't feel, our founders, Eric Kingston and Nancy Altman, did not feel the administration was putting the emphasis on seniors' issues, these vital kitchen table issues like Medicare and Social Security. So they helped create this organization to keep the drumbeat out there to remind the president, you have a large constituency who depend on these benefits that they earned. And we've constantly tried to make the argument that, look, this is not an entitlement. American people paid for it. And they've been paying into the system for 45, 50 years, and they deserve to get those benefits back because they've earned them. The Social Security Trust Fund has a $2.6 trillion surplus. No other aspect or arm of the government has a surplus that large. So next week, the Social Security trustees are going to put out their report, the annual report on the fiscal health of the program, and you're going to hear all these naysayers and sky is falling type reports about how Social Security is going broke. The only people who believe that are the people who say they don't believe that the funds in the trust fund are real, and those are real dollars. Americans earned them through their sweat, blood, working on trucks, working in factories. That money is real, and it will be there. The only way it won't be there is if politicians in Washington choose to take it away, and Americans shouldn't let them.
But isn't Senator Conrad doing the administration's bidding? After all, the president appointed the Bowles-Simpson panel, and after the panel submitted its proposals, the president said that that was a good place to start talking.
What our organization, Social Security Works, would say about that is that politicians of both parties will float ideas out there, some popular, some unpopular, like cutting Social Security benefits. And many times they do that, they do it for one reason. They want to see if people will get active, if they will get loud, and if they will reach out to the president and to members of Congress and say something. And then if they look out there and they see that people aren't reacting, if they're not being loud, if they're not getting in touch with their members of Congress, then they move these ideas forward. To answer your question and to address your point, every person within the sound of my voice, especially if you're African-American, and especially if you're African-American and a female, you need to get in touch with your members of Congress and tell them that cutting Social Security benefits in no way will reduce the deficit. The program has the funds to pay all Americans for the next 25 years and beyond, and that you're going to stay active and loud about this, because the minute you sleep, the minute your eyes get drowsy, you're going to see a proposal either from the president or from someone in Congress trying to cut Social Security benefits. And really what this is, the government has come up short in some of its budgets and on the deficit. So they're looking for the programs that have the money so that maybe they can buy down some of this deficit. But when you talk about real solutions, like phasing out the Bush tax cuts, which would pay for any shortfalls in Social Security, or scrapping the cap on incomes above $110,000, you don't hear talk about those solutions in the media, because those not only are easy, but members of Congress have to make a vote on it. All these commissions, Simpson-Bowles, the Deficit Commission, the debt ceiling, these are easy backdoor attempts. And we've got to fight against that every step of the way.
Don Owens of Social Security Works in Washington. A report by the Inspector General of the TARP program shows the Obama administration has spent only 3% of the $7.6 billion set aside for homeowners in those areas hurt worst by the housing crisis. The money has just been sitting there, unused, for the past 2 years, during which time millions of people, disproportionately Black and Latino, have lost their homes. South Carolina-based activist and writer Kevin Gray says the administration's failure to spend the money doesn't surprise him.
Well, I think that it's been clear from the onset of Barack Obama's campaign through his presidency that he is supportive of this idea of too big to fail, that he's street in the big banks. He made that obvious when he signed off on George Bush's inspired TARP program. And then, of course, when you look at a lot of his policies, they seem to mirror George Bush's policies. So it's no surprise that in looking at the jobs bill that he just passed, that more or less let investors or let Wall Street off the hook with their investors as far as transparency is concerned, that Obama gives fealty to Wall Street and the big banks. And he feels as long as he's got them on his side, then he'll have the mainstream media on his side and mainstream liberals on his side.
Well, what about getting Black folks on his side? These TARP funds were specifically targeted to those areas that were hardest hit by the housing crisis, and that means largely Black people.
Well, Barack Obama really doesn't have to worry about what Black people are going to do when they go to the polls. As long as they have someone that cosmetically looks like them in the White House and they can boost Barack and Michelle up as role models for Black people, then I think that Barack Obama has nothing to worry about. As long as the Tea Party and the racists attack Barack Obama, he has nothing to worry about. And as long as Black people are not organized to make a demand on the system in a coherent way, then he's not really worried. A lot of people, when they lose their home, they believe that it's their fault in the first place, not necessarily the banks. And if they think it's the bank's fault, then where do they go to get any kind of relief? They can't go to the Justice Department. They can't go to the White House. They can't go to any so-called grassroots organization like the Rainbow, like NAN, like NAACP or the Urban League to get any measure of legal relief for their misery. So as long as people have nowhere to go, and as long as Barack Obama only has to reach out to Black voters in the so-called swing states, then there's really no pressure that anybody can exert on his administration.
And why do we have nowhere to go? Is the Black infrastructure so weak, so unresponsive, or just unwilling?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of the above. Obviously, when you look at a lot of Black, traditional Black organizations like the NAACP that are based on a church-like model, those organizations are getting older. And even though there's new young leadership in charge of the NAACP with Benjamin Jealous, there's still a matter of that infrastructure that's in place on the local level, which is primarily older people. It's hard to get young people to actively participate in an organization and to reconstruct the nuts and bolts of those organizations that help people in times of need, to help them when they have problems with their homes, help them when they have problems with the police, help them when they have problems with voting. Those mechanisms are getting old. And, of course, the media and the powers that be promote a certain kind of parachute leadership where people drop in when there's an episode of trouble. But when things are said and done, those folk are extracted or extract themselves from the situation and go on to the next big hit.
So what is a progressive like yourself supposed to do?
All we can do is keep building the contradictions of the empire. Because beyond Barack Obama, it's about the empire, how the empire finances war, how the empire finances the 1% and maintains the status quo. That's what we have to be focused on. We didn't elect ourselves into any problems, and we're not going to elect ourselves out of a problem. And in that, Barack Obama's reelection isn't a sure thing. Folk need to look forward instead of just in November when they go to the polls. And the other part of it is, you know, when you talk about black people and the majority of black people living in the South, where there are Republican-controlled legislatures, they have to look at how to organize on the state level, in particular in the South, where the need is great and where the people are. That's one of the lessons of the mobilization around Trayvon Martin. People ask, well, people seem to mobilize around Trayvon Martin. Well, there's a very simple reason for that. The majority of the people who came out to support Trayvon Martin on the ground are in the South. They can get in the car, they can drive, and be at an event as opposed to going anyplace else, New York, D.C., where they have to have additional expense for places to stay and whatever. But obviously, we have to organize everywhere. But we certainly have to organize where the point of need is. And the point of need is in these GOP-dominated legislatures that are driving the national agenda that has led toward the southernization of national politics, that supports this idea of individual rights and states' rights to exploit people based on race, based on economics, based on ideology.
And clearly, the South is the geography of lynch law, a history of white civilian vigilantism.
Obviously, if you look at Daniel Grau laws, if you look at concealed carry laws, if you look at the attack on women and the attack on contraception and whether or not women can make choices for themselves as to whether or not they want to have a baby and be a mother, if you look at the attack on immigrants, Latino immigrants, if you look at the attack on poor people through drug testing for welfare benefits or drug testing for unemployment benefits, if you look at the attack on workers' rights through attacking organized workers with government or pursuing right-to-work laws, then obviously that fight is coming out of the South and coming out of Republican-dominated states. So that's where we have to start looking at organizing, and organizing in a different way beyond waiting for some administration, any administration, whose sole purpose is the maintenance of the empire. And this idea of American exceptionalism, which is nothing more than Wall Street, global financial exploitation, we've got to focus on the local level and grassroots organizing and helping people create organizations that are democratic in their foundation. One of the problems with some of the organizations, as I mentioned, even like the NAACP, but especially with those organizations like NAN and the Rainbow Coalition, those organizations are based on a personality and based on a person. They're not necessarily based on people coming together, identifying the problem, setting up mechanisms to deal with the problem, and going out there and attacking them.
We're talking about grassroots movement building.
That's what it's always been about, and that's the fundamental problem with what's going on in black politics when you talk about a decline in black politics or a death in black politics. You know, when Dr. King died, there were 100 black elected officials. Now there are over 10,000 black elected officials, and yet the economic stresses against the black community are worse than they were when Dr. King was alive. When Dr. King died, black unemployment was at 8%. Now it's twice that, if not more. So we've got to look at going back to the basics and going back to grassroots organizing, community by community, with local leadership and organizations that are responsive to the people where they live.
Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. In Chicago last week, the International Human Rights Association of American Minorities held a conference. Dr. Francis Boyle, the renowned professor of international law, serves as an advisor to the association. He spoke at the conference dinner on the subject, "Do African Americans Have the Right to Self-Determination?"
I did argue this point before the San Francisco Tribunal, an NGO tribunal organized along the lines of the sort of like a Bertrand Russell's tribunal in 1992, before seven very distinguished judges, human rights experts from around the world. And they rendered a verdict agreeing with me unanimously that, in fact, African Americans were a people with a right of self-determination.
Well, what are the implications of the right to self-determination for African Americans?
What you have to do is turn to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 1, to which the United States government is a party. It says, all peoples have the right of self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. That's certainly one of the consequences. And that is a treaty to which the United States government is a party. They've already recognized then that African Americans have a right to determine their political status and pursue their economic, social, cultural development. Article 1, paragraph 2 says, all people may, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources. We have certainly several areas, states in the South, that are predominantly populated by African Americans. As you know, there's been a claim for reparations for slavery and also land reparations. The Nation of Islam has called for that, and Chakwe Lumumba, his organization, has called for that.
Implicit in the right to self-determination, therefore, is the right to declare one's own nationhood. In fact, a people's nationhood is implied by their right to self-determination, isn't it?
That is correct. There is both external self-determination and internal self-determination, and this is for the people to decide. Do they want their own nation, or do they want to negotiate with the United States federal government on some type of other status or arrangement with the United States government? Again, I want to make it clear, I'm Irish American. It's not for me to tell African Americans what to do. I'm simply here as a lawyer and as an expert to explain what the options are and then how they might pursue these options, these objectives, based on other self-determination struggles around the world.
And what are the possible mechanisms for a people to declare themselves a nation? And that would be recognized by the international community.
Well, back in 1987, in June, I made a speech at the United Nations headquarters in New York as the guest of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And I said the time has now come for the Palestinians to create their own state and apply for UN membership. That's exactly what they did. They created their own state in 1989. And as you know, last fall, they applied for membership in the United Nations Organization for the State of Palestine. So the truth is, not to toot my own horn, but I guess I'm the only lawyer in the world with actual experience at helping a people establish their own state and moving it up to the verge of membership in the United Nations organization. So, again, if that's the direction African Americans want to go, there is precedent here, yes.
And what mechanisms would they use to show the legitimacy of that demand? Referendums? What?
Well, we'll have to discuss this among the African Americans, how they want to do this. In the case of the Palestinians, of course, they had the Palestine Liberation Organization, which the United Nations organization, the UN General Assembly, had recognized as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. And they also had the Palestine National Council, which, although was in exile, represented all Palestinians around the world. And so it was on the basis of those two sets of authorities that the Palestinians set up their own state. Obviously, we do not necessarily have the equivalent of that for African Americans today. I would have to think this through in consultation with African American, certainly political and legal leaders, to figure out the best way to do this, if that's the direction they want to go. The other alternative, as I said, is internal self-determination. For example, I've worked with American Indian nations, and some of them have reestablished their own independent nationhood. Others simply wanted to negotiate a better deal with the United States government. This is for them to decide, not me, and you know, I've tried to assist them to the extent I can. The same's going on now down in Puerto Rico. Everyone in Puerto Rico agrees Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. There's just a difference in opinion about where to go from here, whether Puerto Rico should become an independent state, whether Puerto Rico should become a state of the union, or there should be some type of enhanced Commonwealth status that eliminates the colonial status of Puerto Rico.
So theoretically and legally speaking, and in the spirit of self-determination, African Americans could opt to demand to be recognized as a people, speaking as black people to the United States, without separating, that is, declaring a separate nation from the United States.
Yes, they could. It could be something like Puerto Rico with an enhanced Commonwealth status, sure. There are states in the Pacific Ocean, which the United States government used to occupy after World War II, who have been given certain types of political relationships, compacts of association with the United States government. So there is precedent there, yes.
And can a people be recognized as a separate polity without the boundaries of geography, that is, without being a majority in any particular place?
I think that could happen, yes. We'd have to talk about it. Normally, these types of claims are tied into geography, but there are some precedents where people are recognized as a people with the right of self-determination, with a political leadership authorized to negotiate on behalf of them. For example, many American Indian nations, as you know, have been ethnically cleansed out of their own original territories and moved into what can only be called Bantustans. And yet the United States government does recognize that they are people and they do have rights to negotiate on their behalf. So it does not necessarily have to be territorially based.
And, of course, the Republic of New Africa decades ago declared black people's right to have a nation in the Black Belt. But decades before that, the Communist Party USA recognized that right in principle.
Yes, I did work with the New African people on this back in 1992 and served as a lawyer helping present their claims. That is correct. So we're sort of picking up where others left off and seeing if we can get the ball rolling again. Obviously, situation has changed, but Trayvon Martin, the beast is still there of racism against Africans, and you're seeing all the racists and fascists come out of the woodwork here, even on the so-called TV networks and the talking heads and everything else. So I guess we'd like to think that with Obama as president, we're living in a post-racial America. But as an Irish American, I regret to say I don't think that's the case, and we're far from it. And maybe just focusing on civil rights and civil liberties isn't enough. We've been doing that for quite some time. So maybe we need to put this whole problem, this issue, within the context of international law.
Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is gearing up for a national conference in Newark, New Jersey this summer. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela says the United States is desperate to maintain Western domination of Africa.
The U.S. is one of the forces that's involved in a very serious, aggressive, counter-offensive, I think is a better way to put it. And the reason I would characterize it as counter-offensive is because the U.S. can no longer take for granted the hegemony that it has enjoyed, especially since the Second Imperialist War in Africa, political hegemony, economic hegemony, and that's a lot because of China. China has now become a major force on the continent economically, and because of its economic prowess in Africa, it has impacted considerably on the politics on the continent of Africa, as well as some other places, because now more and more of these neocolonial stooges who have been put in place and propped up by the United States and what people have characterized as Western imperialism for a long time are capable of playing the China card. They don't have to simply deal with the U.S. or France or one of the other countries, and that's contributed a lot to political chaos on as far as the imperialists are concerned and in general. It also is partially responsible for the U.S. needing AFRICOM to try and maintain the status quo. And when we talk about the status quo in Africa, part of what we're talking about, obviously, is the neocolonial puppet rule through which the imperialists have controlled Africa and extracted all of its resources with impunity for a few hundred years. And also, we're talking about the status quo in terms of U.S. and Western imperial domination. Up until recently, two of the most significant contending forces, imperialist forces for African resources, were France and the United States. They have fought proxy wars for a number of years on the continent through various forces. They played a primary role in what we saw happening in Rwanda, the Congo, Ivory Coast for a period of time, etc. And now that struggle between them is being eclipsed by the struggle that both France, the United States, and most of the other Western imperialist countries engaged in with China and trying to control the China influence and also to limit China's ability to extract valuable resources that in the past have gone primarily to the U.S. and to so-called Western imperialists.
We saw all the imperialists and junior imperialists band together for the attack on Libya.
And that was something to behold. But I think even this attack on Libya was a kind of response to the crisis of imperialism in general. And I think that it was really interesting because France, which is in greater economic crisis than most people recognize, and I've even read, in fact, the magazine, The Economist, characterizing France as being in denial about the depth of the economic crisis there. But France, who lives off about 14 so-called African countries on the continent, and if it lost those, that would be it. France is nothing without those. And now it appears that France was the one that really pushed the attack on Libya and had even threatened to do it alone if necessary. And I think that is part of what pushed the United States to having to make a move there to preempt France being able not to attack Libya, but to monopolize the outcome. And I think that's why the United States was pushed in many ways by France, because the United States had actually been engaged for a while now of trying to come to some kind of accommodation with Gaddafi. And I think it was doing that. I think even England, if you remember, had come to some kind of accommodation off of the so-called Lockerbie But I think it was France that pushed it and all the others fell in with it in order not to be left out. And what was really interesting about that is that if Libya could have lasted the resistance a couple more months, France would have had to retreat anyway because it ran out of all resources and ran out of munitions and everything and had to be resupplied by the U.S. and the other imperial powers. But, yeah, they all ganged up on Libya. We saw the result. We saw the lynching of Muammar Gaddafi and the lynching in many ways of the future, at least in the short term, of the people in Libya.
President Obama has embedded U.S. special forces in Uganda, the Central African Republic, Congo, and in the new nation of South Sudan.
In the territory characterized as a new nation, South Sudan, yeah. And, you know, we're looking at some of the same kinds of issues there. I'm told that one of the concerns in Uganda is newly discovered oil and what have you. It looks like every time they dig a hole in Africa now, oil comes up. Of course, in Sudan, there has been a longstanding contention there, part because of China, because China has, in the South, has made significant inroads in terms of oil. And this is a real contradiction, not only for the imperialists, because now you got countries like China, you've got India that's industrializing, you've got other countries that the imperialist white world had succeeded for such a long period in keeping from industrialization, which meant that some of the resources that the imperialist countries held dear and hold dear, they did not have to contend with the China. They did not have to contend with India or Brazil and other entities like that. Now they do have to contend with them. So China in Sudan is a major force in terms of oil. And you know, you've seen the condemnations that China will get in bed with anybody. They don't care anything about dictators, et cetera. And obviously that rings hollow to anybody who's aware of U.S. and Western imperialist relations with all of these dictators around the world. That's what Darfur has all been about. And in an attempt to even rally Africans and others from around the world to call on U.S. or some other kind of military intervention in Sudan to rescue Sudan from the violence of the North and what have you. They succeeded in coming up with a solution in Sudan that resulted in the split of the country so that we have another impoverished African state that they would, if they could, extract a lot more value from. In Uganda, of course, under Museveni, whose name is really revealing because his name comes from, I think, his father, who fought for the British 7th Army Rifles or something like that against the Mau Mau. And Museveni is, that's what Museveni stands for, seven, the 7th Rifle, British Rifles or something like that. And he has facilitated U.S. intervention in Congo, along with Paul Kagame from Rwanda, who was trained in U.S. military institutions here in the United States. And Museveni in Uganda, of course, been a ward of the World Bank for a long period of time. And so, and he's a despot that is responsible for tremendous, just great poverty and oppression of the people, and especially in northern Uganda, that created a lot of unrest that contributed to this Law Freedom Army that the U.S. claims is going in there to try and crush. It is imperialism, again, taking up the white man's burden, having to go in and rescue the natives from themselves. That's what this thing that Obama has initiated. It's a very vicious attack on Africa, a renewed attack on Africa. And the interesting thing, I believe, is that we see now, in the past, we've seen, in the recent past, even France and England and the United States are all having their Africa plans, and China and India with Africa plans, and Brazil, I think, is involved in Africa. And it looks like we see a convergence of all kinds of forces of an imperialism in distress going back to Africa again in an attempt to rescue or resuscitate themselves. And I'm convinced that that's where imperialism will die. The same capitalism and imperialism that was founded in Africa converging there again for resuscitation and to rescue themselves, I'm convinced, will die in Africa as well as the revolutionary process develops and unfolds, because AFRICOM cannot stop that. The people of on the continent of Africa have shown in the past a tremendous capacity for resistance and struggle, and I think we'll see it reemerge in the short term.
So the United States escalates its proxy wars and direct involvement because it cannot contain these rising economic powers.
It cannot contain. And that's a real crisis that we're looking at. There are all kinds of forces that the imperialists are up against. And, of course, for the long period of time, the United States has existed as the chief imperialist, greatest power on the earth, and, you know, has self-proclaimed itself as the greatest empire that will continue to last. But around the world, what we see is just great defeats everywhere. I mean, you know, look at, you know, place like Afghanistan where people can barely afford bread. The U.S. is trying to do whatever it can to get out of there in some ways that will not lose an election right now. You look at Iraq, it did not succeed. It has not succeeded in South America. You know, not only with the Chavez, but Morales and Ortegas and all around the world, the world has just changed. It's been an incredible global shift of power. And the imperialists, including the United States, are trying to contain and catch up with that. And so it is a frantic move. It is not a move that represents strength and power. It is desperation. It is frantic. And many of the pundits, many of the thinking representatives of the U.S. imperialists have conceded that this battle has been lost in terms of the U.S. maintaining hegemony over the world. And most of them, in particular people who are associated with the Obama regime, with that sector of capital, now talking about how the U.S. can maneuver in this situation that it concedes it cannot dominate any longer and still be able to maintain some viable kind of leadership. It is over. And the weakness, of course, in my view, is ours. That is to say, the revolutionary forces, particularly in this country, but not just in this country, because we look around the world and we experience the 60s, and those of us who experienced the 60s remember what the Chinese characterized as a time when revolution was the main trend in the world. And when I think of revolution, I don't think simply of people responding to conditions that are unbearable, in which I think that's really important. I think that's changing the contours of the political arena. But I think we think of revolution, we think of conscious forces who are engaged consciously and transforming these relations of power and creating the ability of the peoples to have possession of their own sovereignty and their own resources. And I see a profound weakness that we represent at this time, even though I think even that is changing. And more and more conscious forces are stepping forward. That's what we are seeing in various places around the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Black is Back Coalition offers, I believe, really profound possibilities here, because it allows people to climb across those sectarian barriers that have often impacted negatively on the ability of there to be some kind of unity in a general struggle against imperialism. And I say this not in some unprincipled unity, because that's still possible. As you know, we've seen a lot of unprincipled unity recently with people willing to get in bed with and become apologists for imperialism. But I think that the Black is Black Coalition gives us a great opportunity, not only here in this country, but we are influencing situations in African population in Europe and in the Bahamas. So I think that's one of the positive things that I see that we are involved in that can make it possible for a real meaningful intervention in this crisis that the imperialists are suffering.
And what's on tap for Black is Back in the coming months?
In the coming months, one of the things I'm looking forward to is in August, where we will, in Newark, do a really important conference on the electoral question, because in the past we've had this discussion around Barack Hussein Obama. And I think that this discussion was limited based on a problem that many Africans at the moment had with criticizing Obama and taking Obama out of the context of the electoral process in this country and in most of the capitalist countries at large. And I think we want to examine what is electoral politics and how do electoral politics contribute to the ability of the people to impact change, and what is capitalist electoral politics anyway? How does that work? And so that's one of the most important things. And also at this conference, what we're talking about being able to do is to, I would hope, have representatives from different forces who are involved in different places in the world. Like there's a Black is Back Coalition affiliate that's in the Bahamas that's running for parliament there. And then various places in Europe and Africa there is some discussion, a lot of discussion going on about elections. In Congo, as you know, I think in November, December, the election there outcome resulted in tremendous mobilizations in the Congo and throughout Europe by Africans, mostly from Congo, who become a part of the Black is Black coalition. And we want to entertain this whole question of electoral politics. It's just one of the most important things that we could do. And then in November, where we annually hold some kind of mobilization in Washington, D.C., we want to have a break the silence mobilization and conference, where we have a march on the White House, where we have a rally first, a march in the White House, and then a conference where we will look at the kinds of issues that confront African people around the world and in this country, and talk about also how we can break the silence, because these are issues that are ignored, not only, oh, I should not say ignored, I should say they are covered up by the imperialists here and ignored by much of what we characterize as the left. And so the Black is Black Coalition has assumed the responsibility to expose these and to try to bring them to the light of day and to put them on the agenda for any legitimate progressive peace activist, anti-war force in this country.
Yes, we see the United States on the move all over Africa, especially yes. in Central Africa, and yet we don't hear a conversation in Black America about it.
No, not a thing. That's, you know, one of the critical issues. I mean, we've had, for example, Black is Black affiliated forces in London had mass mobilization in front of a major news outlet demanding some discussion, demanding some coverage of what's happening in Congo, or the massive demonstration. There have been thousands of people demonstrating throughout the streets, particularly in Europe, but not just in Europe, Australia and other kinds of places, about what's happened in the Congo, and the media will not cover any of that. And so that's deliberate. That's not an accident. And so it's our responsibility, and it's our responsibility, you know, also not to allow things like a Trayvon Martin to emerge as some kind of surprise, or the assassinations of those three Africans in Oklahoma to appear to be some kind of surprise. We have some responsibility, and that's what we need to talk about, of bringing these to light and then making them, putting them on the agenda for resistance and struggle inside this country.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida. UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, plans massive demonstrations in Chicago next month to protest the summit meeting of NATO heads of state in that city. We asked UNAC spokesperson Chris Gavreau how the preparations are going.
Well, excellent. The march is really building. In the last week, we've seen the endorsement of Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push, three major service employees, international unions, Chicago teachers, the nurses union, and many other forces. And we can now see that this march is going to be the major spring march to say no to war and austerity, bring the war dollars home, no to so-called humanitarian interventions that, in truth, are acts of aggression against the right of self-determination and in much of the world roiled by the Arab Spring.
So we're talking about a larger spectrum than what's thought of as the traditional anti-war movement.
I think that the experience of the last year has taught a lot of people the relationship between the war at home and the war abroad, and that we see it's quite interesting that the unions feel the need to demonstrate against NATO, to say no to NATO. I think that's a real advance in politics, and it's a product of a year of increased joblessness, cuts in social services, destruction of public education, and a host of other ills that have been brought down upon people by the Obama administration and Congress.
What are people anticipating in terms of the welcome that the mayor of Chicago is going to give the demonstrators?
Well, I think it's a contradictory thing. I mean, on the one hand, we've all spent a lot of time talking about the sort of outrageous attempt of the Emmanuel administration to paint protesters as violent, to try to dissuade people from protesting by announcing all kinds of equipment purchases and training of police officers and so forth. And then ultimately, of course, the effort to split the movement by moving G8 to Virginia. At the same time, I think we have to recognize that the point of all that is, of course, to instill fear and to be sure that when all the international cameras of the world are in Chicago, that there won't be significant protests, that they'll transmit to all those people all over the world who are hoping, who need to see, who need to know that there's a genuine movement in the U.S. So we've CanGate, which is the coalition organizing in Chicago, UNEC, who's organizing nationally, all of us have waged, really began in August, a civil liberties campaign that I think has drastically reduced the ability of the government to mess with protests against war and austerity in Chicago. In addition to just terrific publicity nationally and internationally, there have been major ads placed in the Chicago Sun-Times where all sorts of prominent civil libertarians made it clear to the government this is a national issue. We have international observers coming, members of Die Linke, a left party in Germany. Parliamentarians are part of an international contingent coming from Europe to observe, to safeguard the demonstrators by acting as international observers of the Emmanuel administration and the Secret Service. So the eyes of the whole world, thanks to our campaign, is much more on the government. We have turned the tide to some degree, and I think that this campaign, which can only be enhanced and made more powerful in the next month as endorsements like the union endorsements and Rainbow Push, etc., and churches who are coming on board continue to grow. We know that all over the country at the Democratic Party conventions and whatever, there are all sorts of moves to really make protest impossible. But the effort in Chicago, both national and international, has, I think, created a situation where we can be confident we can march the permitted march on May 20th and be there for the world to see.
Because of recent events, the struggle for civil liberties is now inseparable from the struggle for peace.
Certainly. What exemplifies that more than drone warfare? Common Dreams had a major article saying that the CIA was asking for an expansion of drone warfare in Yemen. They would no longer have to identify their targets by name or even know who they are, but could send groups to their death by observing patterns of behavior, like taking something out of the back of a truck that might be interpreted as taking explosive out of the back of the truck, etc. And then, of course, these same manufacturers are selling drones now to domestic departments. The prediction for the use of drones for surveillance and law enforcement in the U.S. in the next 20 years is quite extraordinary. And, of course, the increasing efforts to criminalize not only the black community but the Muslim American community is part and parcel of the war effort, demonizing those associated with the countries that the U.S. hopes to dominate.
And the kind of symmetry of no due process for those targeted for assassination abroad, no due process here either.
It's incredible, the Tariq Mahana case, which was just everyone has been commenting on. I think it was Christopher Hedges who said no due process for Muslims. It's now clear. In that case, a young man who imposed U.S. occupation of Muslim land and did nothing but translate information of those fighting against the U.S. military forces in the Middle East was just sentenced to 17 years in prison for somehow aiding, falsely, of course, asserted that was aiding terrorism. Meanwhile, every day we're subjected now to the spectacle of U.S. ground troops in Iraq or Afghanistan marching around with the body parts of the victims of U.S. occupation. Bradley Manning is clearly facing some serious time for revealing war crimes. So we're in a situation where we have to use May 20th to build the movement that can continue to expose these contradictions. And as May 20th shown, we're at the place where we can hopefully begin to bring more people victimized by the economic costs of the war into motion in the streets. If you want to find out more about this action, find out how to get there, find out the demands, go to cangate.org. That's cangate, C-A-N, numeral 8, C-A-N, 8, .org.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.